Hello and welcome back to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science with me, Michelle Hammond, here on UK Health Radio, where we explore how to live well in a world that doesn't always make that easy. Now, today's conversation feels particularly real because we're diving into what it actually means to be human in the modern world. Not the polished, filtered version, but the messy, complicated, emotional, trying to hold it all together version. And I couldn't think of a better person to explore that with than today's guest. Anna Davies is Senior Psychoeducation Manager at The Self Space, a business on a mission to make therapy and mental maintenance part of everyday life. She leads a team of therapists delivering workshops, talks, and training across organisations and communities, helping people better understand their emotional world and how to navigate it. She's also a practicing therapist and, by her own words, a professional human being committed to being unfiltered, compassionate and fully, beautifully messy. Anna, thank you for joining me. Lovely to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure. I'm a therapist. I love chats.
It's what we're good at. And so, Anna, before we delve into your role and what psychoeducation is and self-space for people that aren't familiar, tell me about your backstory. What led you to where you are today?
Oh, okay. Strap in, TED Talk. So, well, I started my career working with children and adolescents and not as a formally trained therapist. I kind of started as a youth worker and then realized that I really loved to work with the most hard to engage kind of children and young people. So I was working with young offenders, people who are at risk of care and prison sentencing, county lines, drugs, gangs, which I absolutely loved. And I think whilst I was doing that work, it became abundantly clear to me that it was really lovely to take them DJing and do lovely things with them. But I just sensed that the power was in the relationship. And I knew nothing about what that meant. It was just a kind of feeling. So I went off and trained to become a child and adolescent therapist. And it just absolutely opened my eyes in terms of the work that I was doing. And that's just taken me all over the place. I've been incredibly lucky to work in a bonkers variety of settings, from some of the most difficult and hard to reach children, young people and their families. And that has a bit of a shelf life. You know, you do need to re-energize because it's tough work, it's hard graft. So then I started to work in education. And it was there that I started to do a lot of group work. I was running kind of behavior centers in high schools. And I just loved working with groups. I'd done so much individual work. And suddenly I had these teenagers who were thirsty for knowledge and had all of their different struggles and their different families and their different cultures and different upbringings. And it started to become abundantly clear to me that education on our mental health is scarce. It's naff. We don't get it. You know, we should have more than we get in our primary and high school education about what it means to think about our mental health and look after ourselves. So started to develop all this group work and training, and that extended into teachers and working with teaching staff and support staff. And then I bounced around working for police forces and being an in-house therapist for them, and then worked for law firms. And all this time I was building group work on the side, and then I stumbled across Self Space and I thought, God, they look cool. I just had a baby. I was coming out of maternity leave and I thought, I'll go and do a little bit of individual therapy. And I spoke to the founder and we just ended up having a conversation about mental health. And I said, you know, my utopian dream really is that when you're born, you get given a kind of mental health surgery, the same as you do a doctor's, and you're educated and supported by mental health professionals. And we just had a brilliant chat. And she came back to me a couple of days later and she said, do you know what? We're starting group work. We're starting workshops. Like, I know you've interviewed to be a therapist, but it feels like this is where your heart is. And then here I am, five, almost 6 years later. So a potted history of me that's gone all over the place. I think working with children absolutely enriched my soul and gave me the goods to be doing workshops and training with grown-ups, actually. It's where my heart is at.
Amazing. And actually, it's really interesting, isn't it? That journey from one-to-one into groups, because actually the dynamics change massively, but the potential within that, because there are so many other benefits of bringing people together.
Hugely, hugely. Do you know what? One of the greatest privileges I think I have as a therapist is just knowing how weird and bonkers and messy we all are. You know, I have worked with CEOs, I've worked with high-ranking police officers, I've worked with really high-functioning lawyers, and I've worked with children from really poor economic backgrounds, from difficult backgrounds and upbringings, and everyone's the same. We're all weird and wonderful, and there is that absolute benefit of group space. And I say it to people all the time, whether you're passively engaging or you're there front and center and you're the talker, someone will say something that you go, I feel like that. Or someone will act in a way or behave in a way or do something. There will be something that is a moment of mirrored reflection that can make you feel less alone. And I just think that's the beauty of group space. You know, even if you've got people who are reluctant to be there, something quiet will be happening and it's gorgeous.
Absolutely. It's so powerful. And your passion for it is palpable, which is even more gorgeous. And so tell me about that dichotomy, because you're so right that the lived human experience is this messy, unlinear sort of thing and unfiltered. And of course, yes, there are always extremes to every scenario and people that get dealt a particularly challenging hand and particularly situations that are outside the norm. But as a whole, what do you think it is of why we kind of have this culture, and particularly here in the UK where we have this huge stiff upper lip culture, hold it all together and carry on regardless mentality. Why do you think it is that we strive to seem as so perfect and so together?
Oh, that's such a good question. It's that I think there's like a simple reason and then there's a myriad of individual reasons for each person. I think fundamentally we are hugely plugged in to an idea of resilience that does not serve us very well. And I think that's been built over time. It's always really interesting because when I think about, you know, I talk a lot to people about nervous system regulation and what functions exist in our body. When we were cave people, the way that we processed our lived experience was to storytell. That's why you see so many drawings. We had limited language, but we storytold. And that is how we processed our lived experience. We would be in a tribe, we'd be in a community. And that has ebbed and flowed across cultures and across generations, and things have changed and life has changed. And I think we're so at odds with not a simple way of living anymore. We're flooded, we're overwhelmed with social media, with ways of being. We're more public. We're not just in our little tribe, we're less private. And I think all of that has an impact, but this idea of resilience that we're plugged into is really tricky. And I think resilience plus stigma equals a really difficult combination of things. So, and what I mean by a difficult idea of resilience is most of the time, if you ask people, what does resilience look like to you? Like, give me a one word association. I will always hear in private work or in kind of group work, strength, determination, bounce back ability, flexibility, smiling in the face of adversity, you know, the courage to power through, being able to manage and deal with what life throws at you. And I always think that's incredibly ironic, because actually, if you called to mind the person you love most in the world and they came and they sat opposite you and they said, I'm not okay, I don't know what depression is, but I think this might be it. It's really unlikely that we would say, do you know what I think you should do? You should just put a smile on that face. You should forge ahead. You shouldn't have told me. Got enough of my own stuff going on. Just bounce back, my friend. You'll be great. It feels really unlikely that that is what we would dial into, because I do believe that we have an inherent well of empathetic wisdom in us that is softer and kinder and more gentle to others. And I think that we dial into a much more difficult idea of resilience for ourselves than we do for others. And we're really good at tolerating, because we don't get taught brilliant emotional literacy, how normal it is for the body to respond to adversity and threat. We tend to think that things that we're sat with, which feel difficult or overwhelming, are bad, and that we should move away from them quickly. And that idea of resilience really kind of pumps that up tenfold. So what you have is people who, instead of attending to their mental health in small bits of dribs and drabs and as and when it's needed, they wait for crisis. And so if we're only ever experiencing crisis, which kind of forces us to have to do something about our well-being, then we're not front and center with the little bits and pieces here and there, and we're not sharing our down days, our messy days, our weird and wonderful days. And so all of that creates a bit of a taboo. So I think that how culture has grown and how we've moved away from how we used to behave as human beings impacts, but resilience and stigma also kind of builds into that as well. And it's about cycle breaking. And let's be honest, like mental health support is a bit of a luxury, whether you're seeking it privately or whether you're going via a doctor and sitting on an NHS waiting list. It is a luxury. So we hold our stuff for longer and it all kind of builds. So I think it's like a mishmash of things that adds up to people not feeling that it's okay to be messy and it's okay to be at your edges, and that is part of the full gambit of human experience. I've probably gone on a bit of a TED talk there, but
actually that is beautiful and really should be a TED talk, because actually that is so empowering for anyone to listen to, isn't it? And to recognize and to be able to just understand deeper and to resonate with. But I think so many young people have this belief that all their emotions, all these kind of feelings they get are often wrong, and because they're not taught about how their bodies function, how their minds work and what these feelings are, they often suppress them. And actually with my Chinese medicine hat on, we often think of disease being caused often by the emotions, by either a suppression or an over sort of expression of them. And it's about balance in there. But so many young people I speak to are afraid of their anger, or afraid of their frustrations, or afraid of the way they feel or the differences they feel. And there's a lot of shame and guilt they hold to express those emotions. But also, even if they understand it, it can be really hard to apply that in a world that isn't necessarily always compassionately open to listen.
Yeah, it hurts my heart when I think about, and there's a lot at play there, right? You know, very therapy statement coming, everyone brace themselves. We're impacted by our childhoods. How we grow up has a huge impact on the core conditions that we carry around within us. I always like to think about young people. And for me, a young person is anything right up to the age of kind of 18, 21. Our brains are still in a huge developmental process. And as we grow, we absorb all the interactions around us, like how people speak to us, how people speak to each other, how grown-ups talk to each other, you know, what culture tells us. And we're absorbing that. And without a huge amount of lived life experience or emotional literacy, we're turning that into black and white rules for life. So that will show up. It's a bit like if you cut yourself in half like a stick of rock, you know, the words that are run through. That's how I like to think about like our core conditions, which is the messages we've internalized about how to be. And so for some young people, it's incredibly difficult to express yourself or feel okay with the emotions that you have. You can have incredibly well-intentioned parents who, you know, are very anxious about big displays of emotions, and you cry and it's, oh, don't cry, suppressing of emotion. Like, even well-intentioned, you don't have to have a very difficult upbringing or a troubled upbringing to have you know, maybe a difficult way of expressing your emotions. We repeat patterns, right, of how we've been brought up. And I think that is an ingredient that impacts children and young people, but also how we are as a culture. And I immediately feel like I'm 90 years old when I talk about social media, but there's a real problem for me with social media, because it can be a brilliant, beautiful thing in terms of connection, community. There's more people talking about mental health on social media, where children and young people are more exposed to words, vernacular, a literacy around emotion. But the problem is that oftentimes people who are talking about that online aren't qualified professionals or don't have a really robust understanding of what they're talking about. So that often means that children and young people mislabel themselves. We're all desperate for belonging, aren't we? Like, we see a label that matches us online and, oh, that's us. And that can send us off on a tangent. And I think emotional vocabulary and safe spaces to express are so important. You know, it's fundamental to our upbringing that we need at least one bloody brilliant grown-up who can take what we offer and who can hold it and hold space for that without judgment. And unless we have that, it's really, really difficult for us to feel comfortable with expressing ourselves. So I think there's a lot at play in terms of how children and young people feel. It is a confusing world to be a teenager, I think, right now, with all the exposure that they have. There's almost too much. There's almost like a hundreds and thousands choice of where you go and find the people that support you. So there's almost too much choice, and therefore it's even more confusing. Plus the fact that, you know, schools, education systems are so overwrought, and really they're like the first line of mental health without any funding and without a lot of professionals in place. So it's really difficult, really, really difficult to know how to express yourself as a young person and how to be okay with what you're holding.
Hold that thought. We're just going to take a quick commercial break. So join Anna and I in just a few minutes.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at a special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science with me, Michelle Hammond, where we're chatting to Anna Davies, the Senior Psychoeducation Manager at Selfspace. Let's jump back in to the conversation. When you talk about psychoeducation, help us understand what your interpretation of that is. What does that mean?
Well, psychoeducation, it's a funny old word, is essentially helping you understand yourself. It's helping you understand the normalcy of mental health. It's breaking down complex clinical definitions and understandings of mental health into a way that feels digestible and easily accessible for anybody. So in essence, we're trying to help people understand what is the difference between pressure, stress and burnout? What is imposter syndrome? What is dopamine? What is it about us that means that we get activated in stressful situations? What is it? What's anxiety? It's basically helping people understand themselves in a way that furthers their ability to have a really good mental health literacy and tools and ways of attending to their mental health in a way that feels good for them and accessible and easy to do. So psychoeducation is helping you understand yourself better.
And so what's the benefit of that? So in your experience and for the time you've been leading this role with Selfspace in the ways that you've applied it, what are some of the positives and the changes you've seen from enabling people to have this deeper understanding and learn more about themselves?
I think that the benefit of understanding yourself, there's two things at play, right? And I think most therapists will probably have this feeling. So when you're sat with one person, the easier work sometimes is having people come to an understanding of, it's really normal that I've arrived at this place, so that makes sense why I feel that way. changing the pattern is harder. So in one sense, I think psychoeducation does the first half of the work, and it's up to the individual to take that and use it in a way that feels good for them. I think the fundamental benefit about psychoeducation is self-reflection. I always talk in our workshops and really lay this out at the beginning, because self-reflection feels like such a faffy, fluffy thing to say. Like, your biggest tool is self-reflection. Great. What am I going to do with that? But it absolutely is, because the more you understand yourself, the better you know yourself, the more able you are to make different decisions about the patterns in your life, the way that you interact, the way that you behave, the things that you think. There's a great psychologist called Carl Jung, psychoanalyst, and God, I hope I quote this correctly. It's akin to, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. And that is one of the most fundamental beliefs that I like to hold dear, because when you are self-reflective, you can make conscious choice. Like, most of the time we're floating around our lives, and what we often don't know is that almost 80 to 90% of the things that we do and say on a daily basis are driven by our subconscious. And our subconscious is our whole lived life experience. So every message we've absorbed, every story we've internalized, every core condition we carry around with us. And that's why we'll find ourselves, God, I'm back in this relationship again. Here I am with the same old person, or I'm back making the same decisions that don't serve me, or I'm back sitting at my desk with imposter syndrome wondering when I'm going to get caught out. And it's because we don't spend enough time with ourselves. We're not necessarily taught to self-reflect and to be curious, like to really hold curiosity without judgment about why we do the things we do and why we say the things we say. So for me, the benefits of psychoeducation, and especially group work, is A, that exposure to difference, to seeing that you are not alone in your messiness, but also understanding ourselves without judgment. I think it's a beautiful thing to witness something as simple as talking to people about their nervous system and helping them understand that actually those last 2 weeks when you felt absolutely at your edges and you were in a complete threat space and you felt really, really stressed, it's not about you. It's not about you as an individual. You know, it's actually about the fact that you're a human with a body and a brain and a nervous system. And if you understand that and remove a bit of judgment, then okay, let's think about what we can do next. So I think the benefit I see in psych ed and in workshops and in that shared space is absolutely about people understanding themselves better and having self-reflection, especially in the workplace, because workplace has evolved massively, especially since the pandemic. But there's still stigma. The evolution of like workplace mental health is like in baby years. You know, it takes years and years and years of change for a real evolution to happen. And so although the pandemic fast forwarded it, there's an openness to bring your best self to work, to be authentic. But let's be honest, work filters into every one of your basic needs. If you think about like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's belonging, it's sense of self, it's purpose, it's feeding yourself, clothing yourself, feeding your family, keeping your mortgage going. It's inherent. And because it's inherent, the threat of not being okay at work is still massive. You're saying something stupid, asking a silly question, all of that imposter syndrome stuff that shows up. So I think that if we can give people permission to know that struggling at work, feeling overwhelmed, not feeling your best self, feeling that sense of imposter syndrome is like an A-OK normal human place to be, and here's some things you can do about that, then that's a job done in my book. You know, that one person who can walk away and think, oh, I'm not weird. That's not about me. It doesn't say anything about my capacity. Actually, I'm just a human being. Then that's brilliant. But absolutely, self-reflection as a tool, I think, is just the best thing. It's wonderful, truly, truly wonderful and joyous to see pennies drop, like in group spaces, because you'll hear a comment, someone will say a thing, their body language will shift, they'll get more involved with conversation. You can see it happening. And that, what a gorgeous gift to be able to give to people. It's such a pleasure.
Yeah, that's incredible. And as you say, it's powerful anyway, isn't it, for the individual?
Mm.
But collectively, to see that happen just absolutely amplifies that power and reach. And actually, I've done a lot of work in workplace wellness strategy because they recognise that, you know, if they want to attract the best talent, if they want to retain the best talent, if they want that best talent, you know, to sort of perform well, they have to support them, not just in their work, but as humans and as individual. And as you say, there's a big difference between recognizing that and doing that well.
Yeah.
And I definitely noticed a shift with the cultural leadership. And
yeah.
So depending on which department you worked in and who your cultural lead was, to how well that sort of played out. A lot of people were still working from early hours till late, putting all these amazing interventions and considerations into place, but yet still not protecting their own boundaries, not being able to truly show up, making a lot of sacrifices.
Yeah.
And also then seeing that people were directly having consequences to sharing how they felt. You know, they didn't get taken for that next promotion, or that opportunity was sidelined for them. How have you seen that change in the last few years, particularly since COVID? Have you seen a positive, tangible difference in the way organisations are better supporting their people?
That's a tricky one right now, because I feel like, and I'd love to pick up on the two things you said about human and leaders, because I just think that's one of the most important things. I think that I have seen positive and negative change post-COVID. The positive change I saw was that suddenly there were budgets. So people had been in organisations for ages. I've worked with so many HR leads and people teams. They are inevitably the people booking the workshops, commissioning the partnership. And they are gorgeous, glorious people who are in HR and in people teams because they care about people. And so I feel like those people have always been there, but the budgets have not been there. And I think for a good 2 or 3 years, there was abundant budgets for mental health, because suddenly, and that's not a fluke, that is because the pandemic, for the first time in most people's lived experience, was a shared experience. So there was no ignoring it. You know, even if you were a CEO, you were still stuck at home baking banana bread and going for your one walk a day and missing your family and loved ones. So for the first time ever, there was shared experience. And that is key, because seniority unlocks budgets. And I think that that had a massive impact. And the work that I was able to do with my team going into organizations was flexible, bountiful, wonderful. I have definitely seen a reduction in mental health budgets in workplace in the last few years, which is really frustrating, because burnout still exists, difficult cultures still exist, culture change, as we said a little while ago, doesn't happen overnight. So it feels like it's kind of stalled a little bit, which I think is a real evidence of the economic place that we're in right now. So I don't think it's just organizations go, well, we no longer care. I think people don't have money. But the desire is still there. And I think what has actually been lovely, but also frustrating at the same time, is that what I have seen is more emphasis on leadership. And that, to me, that's so important, because leaders have such an incredible impact on culture, more than they imagine they do. And from, you know, ex-co right the way down to kind of middle managers. And I think the really interesting thing about managers is the expectation on leaders to attend to mental health is huge. It's no longer just like a nice to have. It's absolutely part of like health and safety at work. But unless you've got a manager who is like very emotionally literate, goes to conversations about mental health, or training as a therapist or a mental health professional as a kind of side hustle, you're not guaranteed to get someone who knows how to do it. And that's okay. People are managers because their expertise in their field, they've got longevity in the organization. They don't become managers because they're really great at having meaningful conversations. So I have seen a real rise in organizations noticing that managers make a big, big difference. And I don't think there's any kind of secret sauce to that. Managers just need to know how to lead through imperfection. A bit like what you were saying, they can say all the right things to teams, but if they're not leading through imperfection, if they're not building trust over time, if they're not being human, then that's a real problem. And I think that's a real culture throwback, right? You know, we workplace has been hierarchical for years. And actually, even if we have an organization that doesn't attest to being hierarchical, as most organizations won't now, and even if we don't feel we respond to hierarchy, we're an evolution version of ourselves and we're pack animals, we're pack creatures. So even if we don't like hierarchy, we still kind of recognize it subconsciously. So actually, it's fundamentally important how your cool manager kind of presents, even if they're super cool and they're really relaxed, how they present is still like a guide for how to be at work. And so I think that more organizations probably need to move towards training their managers, and not just their middle managers, like all the way up, right to the top, because that's culture. It's that culture is created by everybody, but it's absolutely led by the top. So I think the more managers we have who feel emboldened to be human and authentic, I always think that there's like a interesting juxtaposition that people feel to be a bit messy, to be imperfect means you're not good at your job. And actually, if we really recognize human beings, you can absolutely be your authentic self and be wonderful at your job. Messiness doesn't equal not professional. So I think the evolution in workplace is that probably less for employees now. I think it feels like it's gone backwards a little bit, back to kind of tokenism, like a something for Mental Health Awareness Day, something for Suicide Prevention Day, something for men's mental health, and less of a real wraparound offering. But I think people really are trying. I really see that in a variety of different organizations, like the people teams and the HR leads are doing the absolute best with what they have. So it feels like it's kind of ebbed and flowed. It would be wonderful to see it flourish a bit more, because I think the desire is there and the awareness is there, but the budgets aren't there very much anymore, which feels a real shame.
Hold that thought. We're just going to take a quick commercial break. So join Anna and I in just a few minutes.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science with me, Michelle Hammond, where I'm chatting to the brilliant Anna Davis, all about psychoeducation and mental health. And so budgets aside, how else does that flourish from your point of view? If you could magic dust it and the organisations and groups you work with, if you could move forward and make what you would believe would be seismic shifts and changes, what else needs to happen?
Policy. I love seeing organizations that have mental health days the same as they have sick days, like permission, because you're never going to, let's be honest, organizations can offer everything in the world. You could be the jazziest, most brilliant, most on point organization. You've got a policy, you've got this, you've got that, you've got workshops, you've got therapy, you've got a brilliant EAP. It will all still come down to the individual. And so whatever organizations do, I think has to be underlined by they only have so much responsibility, you know, because actually what we do with what's given to us is the fundamentally most important thing. You know, autonomy and mental health is massive. You have to want and do for self to really feel change. But I do think that policy is important. I think just providing permission for people to take rest when they need it. You know, we know all the science tells us, anyone who works in mental health knows that rest and restoration for stress and pressure are the most fundamentally important things. So permission giving, I think, is really important. I'd love to see more organizations investing, as I said, in leadership, because leadership absolutely impacts. I would obviously, and this is a utopian dream, love to see organizations offering flexible therapy to their people. And the reason I say that is not just because I'm a therapist and I think therapy is good. It's because therapy is an inherent luxury. you know, not everybody can afford therapy. Not everyone can access therapy. You know, NHS waiting lists in some places in the UK are 19 months. You know, therapy, especially in central London, very expensive. You know, it's regardless of any way you look at it, it's a luxury. So I think if organisations have the capacity to offer therapy sessions in any way, shape or form, that is an incredibly human gift as an organisation to offer. And I think acknowledgement, I think what I would love to see organisations be able to do is they often get caught up with, we can't mention burnout, or we can't acknowledge that the work that we have you do impacts your mental health in any way, which is such a shame, because actually if we're all on the shared page of course work's hard. Of course, in some, you know, I work with organisers, lawyers, God, lawyers, they're working at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. A lot of creative agencies I work with have got a calm period and there's a deadline and they absolutely cannot miss it. Like, if we could almost acknowledge as organisations from a cultural perspective that actually we know our work impacts you, so here's what we want to do to support you with it, with an acknowledgement that also it comes down to the autonomy of the employee for self, because, you know, each employee comes with a lived experience, lived background, multifaceted human beings. But I think an acknowledgement would be so permission giving. Like, it's not, we don't need to shroud it in secrecy. Like, of course work's hard and people are going to get burnt out. If we could just acknowledge that as organisations, I think we'd be 3/4 of the way there alongside other things wrapped around it.
Yeah, absolutely. And tell me a little bit about Selfspace, because you said you looked at it and thought this is cool and it's kind of revolutionized accessibility to mental health on the high street. So yeah. for people that aren't familiar with Selfspace as a concept, just share a little bit about Selfspace.
Lovely. Okay, so Selfspace is a therapist-founded, therapist-led organisation. So we were founded 8 years ago by Jodie Karras, our founder, who's a therapist. She used to be a television presenter and then she really pivoted and went into work and training as a psychotherapist. And what she really wanted to do was found an organisation that broke down barriers. So barriers are plenty to mental health, some of which I've just mentioned, you know, waiting lists, having to go to your HR team to get a referral when mental health is still stigmatized, access, and just conversations around mental health. And also the idea that therapy is only a crisis provision, which is historically what most people have felt. And that's probably because people, when people think about mental health, they think about mental illness. They don't tend to think about mental health as just what we have. You know, you and I sat here in our mental health right now, it's our every day, it's our thoughts and feelings. So we opened the first walk-in on-demand therapy space in the UK and Europe, and in a little stable in Shoreditch High Street, with the idea that anyone could walk in and get a therapy session with us. So started with a handful of therapists with a real commitment to not have any waiting lists. And it's just grown since then. So we have spaces all across London where anyone can walk in and have a therapy session with us. We commit to no waiting lists, so you can have a therapy session within the hour, online or in person. Got 140 therapists that we have, so that we can give autonomy of choice. I think it's really, really important that the therapist that you sit across from, you like them, not just because they're a lovely therapist, but because you see yourself reflecting in them some way. You like the cut of their jib, the vibe, the banter, or that they look like you or sound like you, or they have a shared lived experience with you. So we really make sure that we've got a huge variety of therapists. And that anyone can walk in off the street and see someone super quickly. So that's one thing that we do, therapy for the people, for the public. We're working every day to try and make sure that it's as affordable as possible. So we have like a pay it forward scheme that we invite organisations to get into to kind of help us offer low cost therapy. We have trainee therapists, so we can offer low cost therapy as well, family therapy, couples therapy. But we also partner with organisations to do two things. One is the side that I head up. So anything that's more than one human in a room kind of sits with me and my team. So that's so diverse. That ranges from training leaders, workshops for everybody, bespoke sessions. We go in and do grief support, if there's been a crisis in an organisation. So anything and everything that we can attend to as therapists, we do. But we also offer therapy via business, and we try to do it in a really different way. So organisations can purchase a bundle of therapy sessions, and they are just there for the employees. So no HR referral, no one at your organisation needs to know that you have them. You can come into space, see someone online and have that therapy that's kind of paid for by your organisation. Yeah, we're on a bit of an ongoing mission. A therapy space on every high street is the name of the game. Kind of world domination is the plan. And we're making things as accessible as possible.
Which is incredible, because actually that accessibility becomes inclusivity, doesn't it, as well? And Adam, I think self-space and all of you wonderful individuals that have been part of it have been part of that evolution of just making people think, well, actually, if it's here on my high street, it's okay. Like, there must be more than just me needing this, and actually just makes people feel like they can approach it. But as you say, a lot of people think they have to either get to crisis point, or they either have to have had some major trauma or huge disadvantage in their life, rather than actually, no, you just have to be human.
And being a grown up. Adulting in the world, be anybody. You know, life is kind of part of our unspoken contract with life, that it will give us brilliant, wonderful days, and it will give us difficult days and messy days. And sometimes that will be catastrophic, and sometimes it will be that it's just a little bit stressful. And I think that I always come back to the idea of, we have this nervous system in our body, and we've only got so much processing space. We've got fabulous brains, but actually they're quite rudimentary in terms of like how they've evolved. You've got a little tiny bit of processing space that kind of filters all our lived experience through and kind of pops it on the memory banks. And if we've got happy, joyful stuff, then that filtering system works beautifully well, and it goes on the memory banks. And if we want it, we can get it. And if we don't, we leave it back there. But if it's difficult stuff, then part of our brain's rudimentary functioning is it shuts down and it doesn't process. So if you've had a hard day, a difficult day, a trauma, a breakup, a hard few weeks, then your memory processing literally shuts down. And the way that we process is to tell our story. And that is basically what therapy is about. It is sitting in a space with no repercussions, no shame, no judgment, absolute unconditional positive regard. And you tell your story so that you can process it and find a bit of space for yourself. And your story might be, God, I've had a really bloody tough week. Or it might be, I've just had the worst breakup of my life, or my parents didn't love me. It's everything about life, you know, the good, the bad, the rainbows, the unicorns, and everything in between. Therapy is absolutely a provision for living life and life experiences. And exactly like you say, we are so good at, you know, very few people find any stigma attached to the idea of going to the doctors. When you think about physical health, we all have a pretty good idea of what feeling under the weather looks like, what needing the doctors looks like, and what needing hospital, surgery, more treatment looks like. And your mental health is like that. We're all going to have our down days, and then we're going to have our days when we need a little bit extra. And for me, that's what like these therapy spaces are. It's just like making it as normal as going to the doctors, walking in. We're very passionate about two things at Self Space, like therapy and really good interior design. So you don't feel that kind of stigma of clinical. You know, when you walk in, white walls, wiped down blue plastic chairs, you know, they're all really beautiful, so that it feels normal.
Yeah, absolutely. And makes people feel like they're entering a living room, which is where we normally have those unguarded conversations.
Yeah,
and actually, it's a really difficult time, isn't it? We were talking before, obviously, the impact on young people, but right the way through, nobody's unscathed at the moment across the generations and demographics. But here we are, probably understanding and knowing more about our minds and emotions and the impact of that on everything from our physical behaviour right the way through to our tolerances and sort of general well-being. But at the same time, people's health and well-being is probably worse than it's ever been. I mean, people are struggling, one, because they feel like, you know, they have to cope and they have to carry on regardless, and all of those stigmas attached. But, you know, heightened levels of anxiety, suicidal ideation, loneliness, as well as the massive escalation in chronic disease is absolutely crippling. You know, how do we move forward? What are some of the ways, just more collectively as a society, that you think could really help move us forward?
Oh, that's a big question. I don't know if I've got an astoundingly wonderful answer to that. I think it's really interesting the word you use, collectively, because actually I think the world is messy right now, and it feels unsafe, and it feels dangerous and overwhelming and horrid at some points. And I think that we collectively is our superhuman power. So like community and being together is incredibly important, but there are less and less opportunities for us. We actually live very individual lives a lot of the time. You know, if you think about young people now, how they socialize, if I throw myself back, because I was a teenager just before mobile phones came in. So if I wanted to be with people, I had to actively seek it, you know, to go out, I had to knock on the doors of my friends. I might have been able to use the old MSN, like dial up chat. But I had to, you know, the only way I got to be with people was to physically be with them and to be in space with the people that I felt really connected to. And I think children, young people have less opportunities to be in community. Yes, they may feel they're in community online, but online is a facade. And being online also opens you up to ridicule, to bullying, to all the other bits and pieces that come with a real negative downside. So I think we need more opportunities to be community. And, you know, you said we have so much more knowledge now about how we are as human beings and how we function. I still feel like that's held by like a pocket of people who are really lucky to know it. Like, how do we as community have more people understand that? How can we feel the power of being together? I don't even know what that looks like or how we create that, but I do think that there is something about togetherness in person with each other, looking into the eyes of another human being, that serves us incredibly well. And yeah, I mentioned it earlier, but I also think that education system, maybe a bit late for those of us that are grown-ups, but education systems are the most beautiful places for us to help growing adults. And there is such a lack of investment in that generation and in those systems in terms of what they're taught, the mental health professionals they're able to have in, any of that that kind of helps them understand themselves better. I mean, wouldn't it be beautiful to imagine having mental health access in all schools so that it's just normalized and there's more of a literacy for this next generation of growing young people? So I don't know if I have the answer, but I do think it's something about leaning into community, because we fundamentally need that. You know, we do need that, and there's less and less opportunity. There was a minister for loneliness appointed, right, a couple of years ago. Loneliness is an absolute epidemic, and you don't have to be solitary and alone to feel alone. So there is something about how we have more conversation with each other, how we're more in space together. That's just one thing, but it feels really important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that community and sense of connection and belonging is fundamental, isn't it? Anna, what do you do for your mental health and well-being? So give me some of the top tips that you have, or some of the ways you help yourself when you're having wobbles or those down days. If it all feels just a bit too messy and much.
Buckets of gin. I'm imperfect. I have to remind myself very often what I need to do for myself, because I work and I'm a mum and I have a husband. He very much takes care of himself, so not a lot of hard work on my part there. There's loads of different things. I think walking, I love a walk. I'm very lucky where I live and a walk for me is absolute solitary me time. Very contra to what I've just said about community, but I'm so busy all of the time that actually just to have space to process, whether I'm listening to a podcast or an audio book or whatever that looks like, is really important. And decompression, regular and often. I don't have time. I'd love time to be like going to hot yoga and retreats and all this kind of stuff all the time. But actually, that won't ripple out into the rest of my life. Like, a hot yoga session's wonderful, but it won't spare me the rest of the week. So just finding times to be kind of still and doing a bit of breathing, or, you know, listening, or, you know, I'm not really a meditator, but I'm definitely a decompressor. I sit on that kind of relaxation space. So a bit of progressive muscle relaxation, bit of cooking, losing myself in something that is just for me. So I repair some kind of different parts of myself, and also challenging my own thoughts. I'm a classic terrible person for paying too much attention to what I like to lovingly call my inner shitty committee. So the voice that tells me, oh, well, you've left that conversation looking like a right idiot, or everyone thinks you're talking rubbish. I have to really kind of nurture the care council part of me and try and switch that part off. And I think that that is just as fundamentally important for my rest and just connection with loved ones as well. But as I say, imperfect, I have to work at that. It's very, very easy to get to the end of a week and go, God, why am I so stressed? And then think, oh, I haven't actually attended to the parts of me that need a bit of life and need a little bit of encouragement. So it's a bit of perseverance and remembering and downtime and regular decompression so that my nervous system feels settled.
Yeah, beautiful. And is there anything, Anna, we haven't touched on that you think would be important for our listeners to know or understand?
I just think that the one thing I always, always love people to take away is like self-reflection is king or queen. You know, if you always do what you've always done, then you'll always get what you've always got. And if change feels necessary, then self-reflection's your golden starting point. With help or alone, whatever feels good for you.
Anna, it's been an absolute joy to speak with you and listen to all your wisdom. And I'm absolutely sure that all of our listeners will take so much from that conversation. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a joy. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Well, what a brilliant conversation with Anna. I love her honesty and her insight. And it's a great reminder for all of us that being human isn't something to fix. It's something to understand, to work with, and at times to gently make space for. And if this episode has sparked something for you, please do share it with someone who might need to hear it too. These conversations matter and they reach further because of you. You can follow, like, and stay connected with the show on UK Health Radio or via my social media channels. And if you'd like to explore more of my professional training courses and work, you can do that by jumping over to Teapot Education at tpot.org.uk. And if you're interested in one-to-one support, you can access my private practice website at michellehammond.co.uk. And as always, thank you for being here, for listening, and for being part of this growing conversation. Until next time, take care of yourself and each other.